at verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and went towards Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land in which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at the first. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. May God bless to us this reading. Now we're going to read in John's Gospel, chapter 1, from verse 35. Now John's Gospel, chapter 1, is really a chapter of introduction, as you would expect in most books. They have an introductory chapter. And here he is introducing the theological ideas that he's going to develop in the course of his book. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then he moves on to the testimony of John the Baptist, and then to this idea of discipleship. And some disciples come from John's word, some comes by Jesus' invitation, and some come by invitation of their friends or brothers. And then in the bit that we're reading, there's certain titles given to Jesus that are important, and they're going to be developed in the course of the book. So he's introducing these subjects here. And we could perhaps bear that in mind as we read this. John chapter 1 from verse 35. Jesus calls the first disciples. The next day again, John was standing with two of his disciples. That's John the Baptist was standing with two of his disciples. And he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, behold, the Lamb of God. There's the first title, you see. The two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, what are you seeking? And they said to him, Rabbi, which means teacher, where are you staying? He said to them, come and you will see. So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the sixth hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his own brother Simon and said to him, we have found the Messiah, which means Christ. He brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, so you are Simon the son of John. You shall be called Cephas, which means Peter. The next day Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, follow me. Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." May God bless to us this word too. Now we want to look at John's Gospel chapter 1 and this story of Jesus and Nathanael. And really the climax of this story is in verse 51. "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Now, when we read this, I said that this was introductory. And I drew attention to the titles of Jesus. In fact, I pointed out the first one, the Lamb of God. But if you look at this, you see there's quite a number of concepts about who Jesus is that are brought out in these verses. He's spoken of as the Messiah. He's spoken of as the one that Moses spoke about and one whom the prophets spoke about. He's called a rabbi. And he himself calls himself the Son of Man. So what we've got here are titles that refer to Jesus, ways of looking at Jesus. And these are introductory because he's introducing them here so that he can develop these ideas in the course of his gospel. I don't know if I've got this quite right, but I look at this as an artist. You know, he's got a picture in mind that he wants to paint, and he got his palette and he prepares his colours and he gets the right shade of blue that he wants for the sky and the right shade of brown that he wants for this and the right shade of blue that he wants for that, and he's got all his colours there ready made, and then he takes them and begins to paint his picture. That's what John is doing here, I suggest. He's laying out his stall, you might say. He's preparing his palette, let's say, and he's going to paint a picture of Jesus. And that reminds us what this passage is all about. You may say it's about Nathanael. Oh yes, it's about Nathanael. But it's not mainly about Nathanael. It's about who Jesus is. And that's what we're looking at this morning. Who is Jesus? And I'm not going to say anything new here, not very new anyway, and I'm not going to say anything very practical either. I'm just trying to show you a picture of who Jesus is. After all, we have to live our lives looking to Jesus. And even just to have a picture of Jesus painted before our mind's eye, I hope that will be of use to us day by day as we seek to live our lives looking to Jesus. So how do we see him in this passage? There's three ideas. We see Jesus despised because of his lowly background. Jesus acknowledged because of his prophetic insight. And Jesus communicating with heaven. Let's begin with Jesus despised because of his lowly background. Here's the way it begins. It begins with Philip, who has been called to follow Jesus and who has now some idea of who Jesus is. And he comes to Nathanael, and I see him bursting with enthusiasm, breathless with excitement. And he says, "We've found him of whom Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote. He's Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." That's what Philip thinks about him. Now, we don't exactly, I don't profess to know exactly what Philip had in mind here. One of whom Moses in the law spoke. Well, is he thinking about what was promised way back in Genesis 3, the seed of the woman that would bruise the head of the serpent? Or is he thinking about things that were said about the house of Judah and a king coming from that line? Or is he thinking about the sacrifices even, so that he has begun to grasp that Jesus is the Lamb of God who fulfills all these sacrificial lambs that are mentioned in the law of Moses? Or there was this idea that Moses had foretold a prophet that was to come. Is that what he's got in mind? And probably the last of these is probably what he's got in mind. But there's a whole range of things that he might be thinking about. And even when it comes to the fact of him being one of whom the prophet spoke, you know, there's a choice there as well. There's the suffering servant of Isaiah, or there's the branch that comes out of David's line, the Messiah, the king coming from David's line. There's a choice there. Other ideas as well. What's he thinking about? Well, I think he's thinking about the Messiah, probably. So that probably what he's got in mind is the prophet and the Messiah. We found him. But the point I want to emphasize is the big thing here is the scriptures have been fulfilled. For hundreds of years, they've been looking forward to this. And now it's happened. The prophets have spoken, Moses has spoken in the law, and that was thousands of years ago. And now it's come to pass. Wonderful news. Extraordinary. If you've been looking forward to something eagerly, you don't know when it's happening, and you've looked forward to it for a long, long time, and then it happens, how excited you get? How much more so when they had been looking for centuries for this? God is no longer silent. He's at work again. He's bringing into being what he promised long ago. That's the big message that Philip has. Now, how does Nathanael react to that? He is, as we are going to look at in a moment, a godly Jewish man who presumably is looking forward to these things as well. And he views this in a rather negative fashion. And so poor Philip, bursting with enthusiasm, and Nathanael comes and pours cold water on his ideas. Can anything good come out of Nazareth, says Nathanael? Now, that sounds very, very negative indeed. Indeed, it sounds quite out of character with what we know of the man later. But I would like to say it's not perhaps quite as negative as you might think, because after all, was Nazareth mentioned in the Old Testament in connection with any of the prophecies? Nazareth isn't mentioned in the Old Testament at all. It was from Bethlehem the king was to come. And so Nathanael perhaps is informed by his knowledge of the scriptures in part. And he says, well, that's not mentioned in the Bible. It doesn't conform to what we could reasonably expect. But he goes a wee bit beyond that and says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? He's despising Nazareth. And I don't think it's too difficult to see why he's despising Nazareth, because many people nowadays in the cities might despise people from the country. And Nazareth was from a hill village, way back at the back and beyond, a backwater. Not the sort of place that a king is going to come from. Not a place that a leader is expected to come from. The people there are living in a backwater. That's the sort of idea that I think that Nathanael's got in mind. And you see, he's judging by outward appearance. He's judging by human factors. And he's despising the lowly background from which Jesus came. Now that is not something unusual actually in the Gospels. The people, when Jesus was teaching, said, where can this man get these things? What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? is not this the carpenter? He's just a joiner. He's not been trained. He's not been raised in the right academic schools. He's not a figure who has been associated with people of wisdom and understanding and insight. He's just a joiner, judging by outward appearances. And it didn't fit in with their way of looking at things, and they couldn't figure it out. Jesus judged by his outward appearance. Jesus judged by his background. Jesus judged by things from a purely human perspective, and people don't look kindly on him. He was despised and rejected by men. Men looked at him and there was no beauty in him. They looked at him and saw something outward and weren't attracted to him. And so, I mean, I think Peter says, Paul says this, speaking about the offence of the cross. We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. Jesus crucified, it doesn't fit. It doesn't make sense according to human wisdom. How can a crucified person give life? How can a king suffer like that? Or as Muslims generally say, how can it be a prophet? God would never have let his prophet die on the cross. Actually say it the other way around. How could he have died on the cross if he was a prophet? But the point I'm making is, by outward appearance, Jesus has nothing. From a backwater, just a joiner, put to death on the cross. From the human perspective, it doesn't make sense. And he's despised because of his lowly background. That's the sad picture that we've got him at the beginning from Nathaniel. Okay, remembering that then, let's move to the second step. And here we've got something completely different. Jesus acknowledged because of his prophetic insight. Now, the story goes on like this. Philip very wisely says, come and see. That's the antidote that's the solution to Nathanael's problems. You don't think Jesus measures up to your standard because he comes from Nazareth, which isn't mentioned in the scriptures, and he comes from a backwater which isn't likely to produce a king. You think that then. You just come and see for yourself, which is very sound advice. So, Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, behold, an Israelite indeed in whom there is no deceit. Now, this part of the story begins with Jesus' assessment of Nathanael, and it ends with Nathanael's assessment of Jesus. So this is Jesus' assessment of the man. Here is a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false. This reminds us of the way that Paul spoke. There are sons of Abraham after the flesh, and there are sons of Abraham after the spirit. You can inherit the genes of Abraham, or you can possess the faith of Abraham. So Paul could say, not all those that are Israel are of Israel, or something of that nature. There's two ways of looking at things. You can look at them according to the flesh, or you can look at them according to the spirit. And what Jesus is saying here, if you could use that idea at least, he's saying he's a true Israelite. He's not just one genetically. He's not just a descendant of Jacob, of Israel, genetically. He's a true Israelite. One that has got the faith of Jacob. One that's got the faith of Israel. This is a truly godly man. This is a righteous man. This is a man that appreciates covenant blessings. This is a man that rests upon the promises given. This is a man of faith. He's not just an Israelite in name. He's an Israelite in deed. He's one of God's people indeed, not just nominally so. That's what he's speaking about here. And he says he's one in whom there is no guile. There's nothing deceptive about it. It's not that he goes through an appearance of worshipping God, an appearance of religion. The reality is there. It's not that he's got outward form and that's all that there is to it. He's got the real thing. What you see is what you get in the case of Nathanael. So it's a pretty high recommendation that is given here. It reminds me of what was said of Simeon, the man that met Jesus in the temple. He was righteous and devout. Or it makes me think that he's got the mindset of Anna, who's connected with that story too. She worshipped with fasting and prayer night and day. Jesus is saying, that's the sort of spirituality, that's the sort of true religion that this man has got. He's a genuine Israelite, in the highest sense of the word. Now, it's obvious that Jesus says this as Nathanael approaches, but Nathanael hears what he says. And so Nathanael said to him in verse 46, "How do you know me?" And Jesus tells him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Now, there's two fairly different ways of interpreting this. I've heard it said that Jewish men, for the sake of peace and quiet, went under a fig tree to do their devotions. There was shade there from the sun. There was quietness that there might not be in the home. And the leaves of the fig tree might, to some extent, give them privacy. And therefore, doing your devotions under a fig tree was, I'm told, quite normal. And that's what Jesus is saying. I saw you when you were doing your devotions. And the idea that some people have is that he didn't see them with the physical eye because he's God. He saw them when he was praying because he heard his prayers as God. And that's one way of interpreting this. The other way is quite matter of fact compared to that which is quite supernatural. The other way is simply that he had passed by that way before. He had seen Nathanael under his fig tree and he had remembered him. And when he sees Nathanael coming to meet him, he has insight to know what sort of a man he is. And he says, "I saw you when you were under a fig tree. You indeed are an Israelite in whom there is no guile." It's quite natural that way. He had seen him before, he remembered him, he had this insight into character, as we see in other cases as well, and that's what is given expression here. Now, for myself, I tend to go to that second position. Nowhere in the Old Testament do you find the fig tree as being a place where people did their devotions. Maybe it is so, it hasn't left its mark on Scripture. In fact, what is said about the fig tree in the Old Testament is very much that being under your fig tree was a sign of domestic happiness and security. Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree. That means everybody felt secure in their own home. They shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. To be under the fig tree in the Old Testament is to be at home, in your backyard, sheltered by a fig tree, with your family, your children around you, in security and happiness. And that's the way I like to think about this. So Jesus says, "I was passing by before and I saw you in your yard, under your fig tree." He was maybe conversing with others, maybe playing with the children, whatever. He saw him there. And he recognizes him when Philip brings him, and with his special insight, which we know operates, he was able to see what sort of man he was. And that's the way I think we should think about this. So, Nathanael, therefore, is taken by the prophetic insight of Jesus. And that's what moves him to say what he does say. And what he says is this: "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." And there you see, he's the Messiah. He's the King that's promised. He's the one that serves God, acting like a son to him. He's the King of Israel. And you see his opinion has completely changed. Now, you may say, and I'd said it to myself, how did this saying of Jesus, "I saw you when you're under your fig tree," make him change his mind so radically and completely just like that? Well, I don't think it was just like that. I think he changed his mind because he was a true Israelite. Here's Simeon in the temple. He knows he's not going to die until he sees the Christ. And this family comes in, and there's maybe 20 other families coming in as well, and people milling around in the temple. How does Simeon know that that baby was Jesus? He just knew, because he was a righteous man, and he had insight through the Holy Spirit, and he knew that that was the child that had been promised. How did Anna know? The same reason. She just knew, because she was a child of God, and she knew the things of God, and God showed her what was what. How did Nathanael know this? Because he was a true Israelite. And to true Israelites, the will of God is known. He just knew. When he heard Jesus say that, his doubts fled away. He just saw things as they were. And he said, "You are the Messiah. You are the expected King of Israel." And that's the second picture that we've got of Jesus here. Jesus acknowledged because of his prophetic insight. And you might think, that's great. Can we go any higher than this? Isn't this what we should be looking at? That he's the Messiah that was promised, the great King. Can you go further than that? And that leads us to the third thing, you see. Because here Jesus says, yes, you can go much higher than that. He's not denying that he is the King of Israel. He's not denying anything that's been said about him. But he's saying there's something greater. Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree. Do you believe? You will see greater things than these. And that leads us on to Jesus communing with heaven. Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Now, what does that mean? Well, firstly, I think we have to say quite clearly, if you're looking for a literal fulfillment of that, I think you're really going to look in vain. Okay, we can bring in accounts of angels in connection with the life and ministry of Jesus, but I don't really think you can prove that this happened literally. Jesus spoke in figures. He constantly spoke in imagery, and I think that's what he's doing here. Angels are basically messengers, and he's speaking about messages going back and forward from heaven to Jesus, from Jesus to heaven. And he's saying, you'll see messages going from Jesus to heaven and from heaven to Jesus. You'll see Jesus communing with heaven. And if you think about it, you see that that, of course, was the case in his life. Now, I'm sure there's much more to it than this, but I'm just limiting it to this. Just think about the way that Jesus prayed, and the way that answers were given to his prayer. And Luke is the one, of course, that tells most about Jesus' prayer life. But when John talks about his prayer life, he does it in a quite distinctive fashion. And I've got a couple of cases here where what is emphasized is Jesus sending his message to heaven and heaven sending a message back to him. There's this case of Jesus when he had raised Lazarus from the dead. Now, that was a significant event in Jesus' life and ministry. And it was a remarkable thing at any level. And what does Jesus think about the matter? Well, we're told in the aftermath of that, Jesus lifted up his eyes. So here's this heavenly look. Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." So here is Jesus saying, I'm always in touch with you, and you're always in touch with me. And I'm letting this known to people so that they might believe who I am. And it seems to me that that is a fulfillment of the basic idea of what Jesus spoke about in John chapter 1. A message has gone up. A message has come back. People reckon, see it, and are meant to believe in him accordingly. A chapter later, there is another important event in Jesus' life. Greeks come up to the feast, and they want to see Jesus. Now that's a big thing, because Jesus, in Matthew's Gospel, he says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And that was so at that time, but later on he said, go and make disciples of all the Gentiles. So this is a big thing in his ministry, although immediately the Jewish people are particularly in mind, ultimately the whole world comes into view. And that's what's happening here. The Greeks come to Jesus. In fact, they don't come to Jesus. The Greeks come to Philip, who was from beside in Galilee, and they asked him, Sir, we wish to see Jesus. And Philip relays the message to Jesus. And Jesus is overwhelmed by this and begins speaking about his death and so on. And quite an elaborate speech he gives there. And then he addresses God and he says, Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But from this cause I came unto this hour. Father, glorify your name. So here he is communing with heaven publicly so that all can see. Communing with before Philip of all people to whom this original saying had been given. And there's a response to that message that he sent up to heaven. And it's a message that comes back from heaven. Then came there a voice from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. So, a messenger, as it were, has gone to heaven. A messenger has come back from heaven. Jesus communing with heaven. And what do the people think about this? The crowd that stood there and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said, an angel has spoken to him. Well, that's the sort of thing I think that Jesus had in mind. And that's, I was going to say more, but I'll leave it at that. That's the basic idea that we've got here. Jesus is saying, okay, you acknowledge me as the Messiah, you know, but there's something greater than that. If you want to see me in my full glory, you have to see me communing with heaven. What a status I've got, what an authority I've got, what a mission I've got. Me being constantly in touch with heaven. A two-way traffic. I speak, he answers. I speak, he answers. I make my prayer, a voice comes from heaven. That's the way you have to look at me. That's who I am. Not just the Messiah, but something greater. It was the same way when later on in the other Gospels, Peter confesses Jesus as the Messiah. You're the Son of the Living, you're the Christ, the Son of the Living God. And Jesus immediately goes on and says, I'm going to suffer and I'm going to die and be raised from the dead. So Peter's made a great confession, you're the Messiah. But it's not the final word. There's something more than that. And that's what Jesus is speaking about here too. Don't just see him as the Messiah. See him in his intimate relationship with the Father and all that is implied in that. So, what's this story about? It's don't look at Jesus from a worldly point of view. Don't assess him by what the eye sees, by his background, by his lineage, by his outward situation. Don't judge him by outward appearances. This is what Paul did. He said, once I knew Christ according to the flesh, meaning I only looked at him in an outward way and I didn't understand really who he was. And looking at Jesus in an outward way led to him persecuting his people. To see Jesus according to the flesh is a non-starter. So if you only look at Jesus as somebody that was a baby born in Bethlehem, or a man that came from the outback, from the back of beyond in Nazareth, if you only see him as somebody that suffered and can't understand why he suffered, if you only see and analyse him with the human mind and from a human point of view, you're far from the truth. That's a non-starter. You haven't to look at him in that way, says Jesus. You can look at him as the Messiah, and that's a great way to look at him. He's fulfilled the scriptures. He's the great revealer, therefore, who's brought revelation to its climax. He's the great king of David's line. He demands your allegiance because he is king. He demands your obedience because he is the great revealer, fulfilling the Old Testament scriptures. By all means, look at Jesus in that way. Submit to his teaching, recognizing that the human mind is insufficient to grasp the things of God, and that you need a revelation from above, and that that's found especially in the life of Jesus. Look to him as a sinner that has strayed, who needs guidance and help and support. Look to him as the king, and give your life to him, and yield yourself to him. But above all, this passage is saying, look to him as the one that communes with heaven, so that when he prays, heaven answers. Now you may think that that's a wee bit weak. And I do acknowledge that it lacks a practical dimension that I'm not able to give. But I would suggest this, that my natural reaction, people's natural reaction that are Christians, would say, well, where does the cross come in all this? You know, it's Christ crucified that we're meant to look at especially. This matter of him communing with heaven and heaven speaking to him, where does the cross of Christ come in that picture? Well, I would just like to finish with this idea that it fits in very well. Because in the lead up to the cross, Jesus prayed. He said, let this cup pass from me, if it's possible, if it be your will. On the cross, he said, my God, praying to heaven, why have you forsaken me? On the cross, he said, into your hands I commit my spirit. So that on the cross, he was communing with the Father at a certain level, certainly, even when he said, why have you forsaken me? That was his look as he lifted his eyes to heaven, literally from time to time. So he lifted his heart to heaven constantly, even in the run-up to his crucifixion and in the crucifixion itself. Were these prayers heard? Well, yes. Hebrews tells us this. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Now, when did he offer up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears? Unless it was in Gethsemane, in that sort of setup. So he was praying to God, aware of the anguish that he had to undergo. He was praying to God in the midst of his anguish, with loud cries and tears, and he was heard. And that's why we sang Psalm 21. I should have apologised beforehand that we had to sing that in an old version. The new version has got a strange tune that I reckon we couldn't sing. And anyway, the old version is much more familiar to me than the new one. But I apologise for the old-fashioned language. But really, it's very, very important, that psalm, if we can keep it in mind. When he desired life of thee, thou life to him didst give, even such a length of days, that he forevermore should live. Did Jesus pray on the cross? Yes. Was he answered? Yes. When he desired life, it was given to him, even such a length of days, that he forevermore should live. The answer to Jesus when he prayed in anguish, when he prayed on the cross, was a deed. It was the resurrection from the dead. The Father raised him from the dead. I know Christ rose from the dead, but some passages say the Father raised him from the dead. God raised him from the dead. And that's true, because it was the response of heaven to the prayer of Jesus. In the garden, on the cross, it was heard. He was communing with heaven, and heaven responded. And so, if we think of the cross as being the centre of the gospel, why not? We can combine that with this idea. Keep this in mind. Jesus constantly communed with the Father, and the Father responded in a fitting way. Sometimes he did it inwardly, we might say. At other times he did it outwardly, so that people heard him speak, thought it was an angel indeed. And sometimes he did it by the act of raising, once he did it by the act of raising Jesus from the dead. So there's no conflict between looking at Jesus as the great one that communes with heaven and heaven communes with us. Because on the cross, that's what happened too. And that's the thing we've got to have in mind before us. Look to Jesus as the Saviour, as the one that died for us, as the one that was raised from us. That's the Jesus that we have to have before us. And looking to him in that way, we will discover this, that we will commune with heaven, and heaven will answer us. Because Jesus is seated at the right hand of the Father, and he's praying for us still. He's communing with heaven still, and his prayers are still being answered, the prayers that he offers up for us. So look to Jesus in this way, and we can live our lives in a fitting way, looking to Jesus. May God bless to us his word.